Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So one of the issues that's made it into our national conversation over the past year, certainly in the last few months, has been some discussion about President Donald Trump's state of mind. It's often been a discussion that comes after some kind of especially provocative tweet or statement or stories coming out from books like Michael Wolff's book about what's going on in the White House. There have been some politicians, some commentators who have openly raised questions about his fitness to govern, the stability of the president of the United States. It's been connected with some of his critics to the possibility of using the 25th Amendment if things got particularly dangerous. And there have been some psychiatrists who've been breaking with the famous Goldwater Rule, which we'll discuss a little bit today, and raising questions about whether he is fit to serve. So this has moved, I think, from a conversation that was on the far periphery to getting more attention front and center in recent weeks. And there's been pushback to some of that kind of commentary in terms of how this kind of analysis and diagnosis could be made. So today, to discuss this, we have Dr. Bandy Lee from Yale School of Medicine. She's an MD, an assistant clinical professor. She's part of the Yale Law and Psychiatry Division, a co-founder and director of the Violence and Health Study Group for the Macmillan Center for International and Area Studies, as well as co-leader of academic collaborators for the World Health Organization's Violence Prevention Alliance. She is the lead author of a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, a best-selling book published by Thomas Dunn Books. Dr. Lee, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Maybe we can just start for listeners who don't know this term. What was the Goldwater Rule?
First of all, let me clarify that I'm speaking for myself and not for Yale University, Yale Department of Psychiatry, or Yale School of Medicine. The Goldwater Rule, actually, I think has been over-discussed. It's not so much because of the importance of the rule. In fact, many psychiatrists had not even heard of the rule before this administration. In other words, it was an obscure rule on its way out, contradicted by science and evolving practice, until, I believe, it gained political expediency. So what the Goldwater Rule says is this, that if we are asked about a public figure, we may comment on general psychiatric matters, but we should not diagnose someone we have not examined in person and gotten consent to speak about. And I actually agree with that. As a forensic psychiatrist, I have often been asked to diagnose minor public figures in court cases, and I have always refrained from doing so just as a standard of my own practice. But 2 months into this administration, this obscure rule was turned into an absolute decree that really has served as a silencing mechanism. In other words, they changed their interpretation. The American Psychiatric Association changed its interpretation from not being allowed to diagnose public figures and to the media. Actually, they once specified that at one point, to not making any comment whatsoever about any observable aspect of their expressed emotions, their speech or behavior in any setting, including in an emergency. Now that actually requires the adherent of the rule to go against the ethical principle it falls under, which is to contribute to activities that promote public health, as well as it goes against, you know, the Universal Declaration of Geneva, the preamble of the APA Code of Ethics itself, the Code of the AMA, and the Hippocratic Oath. So it makes no sense at all, other than the political context.
Let me just jump in here and back up a little bit. I think we're already in some interesting political weeds talking about the Goldwater Rule. And I just want to back up and just ask just the general topic. Let's say that we're just sitting around the faculty lounge And we're just asking the question, okay, so how do you evaluate a person when you don't get to meet them in person? All you get is what you get through like these snippets of audio and video and so on. Just, you know, it sounds like you've had to do this before. And in some ways it's tough. And so I'm just curious, just if you could walk us through, how does, you know, in your, you know, as a professional, how do you figure out what's happening with a person when you get limited doses of being with that person?
Right. In fact, I don't think that a diagnosis is possible without a full evaluation, getting all the information. In fact, you need medical records, their list of medications, you need collateral information, and sitting with a person is a huge part of where we get our information from. But we're not talking about diagnosis here. Diagnosing is a very specific, intricate activity that leads to a specified diagnosable mental disorder, which concerns the person's prognosis and treatment. And so it's really a personal affair. What we're speaking about here is, especially the book itself, is speaking about dangerousness, which you do not require all information to be able to assess. In fact, you only need enough information to raise alarms. Many people do not realize this, but mental health professionals do not just deal with mental illness. They also deal, in fact, more universally with dangerousness. If someone is a danger to themselves or others or the public, we are actually required to act, not only legally authorized, but legally could be held legally liable. We're mandated reporters and warners and protectors of public health and safety if it comes to that. And so, so it's actually not outside of our ordinary practice that if we detect any signs of danger, and in fact, it's something that any ordinary person could detect as well. Certainly, specialized knowledge would give you an advantage. We do not leave all our knowledge behind when we leave our clinics. In other words, we study patterns of thought and behavior and how that manifests on a daily basis. So, of course, there's a lot we're going to detect. And, of course, we're going to detect it far before the lay public does. In fact, the book, when it was put together late April, early May, it was around the time when the nation was feeling that the president was finally settling into his presidency and he was going to pivot and become normal. We predicted otherwise. We predicted that his condition was far worse than people were imagining, that he would grow worse over time under the pressures of the presidency, and that eventually it would become very dangerous, involving, including nuclear weapons. And this is exactly what we're seeing today.
Well, maybe you can unpack that a little more. You've also spoken to members of Congress about this, and the idea that he is dangerous, in contrast to criticisms that might be made of other presidents who have been bellicose, who have endorsed the use of military weapons, sometimes getting far ahead of themselves in how they do that. How are you characterizing the particular case of President Trump as dangerous, as something people need to understand as a distinct problem, as opposed to the normal kind of criticism you might have about the politics or policy of a president?
Right. That's where mental health professionals could perhaps be most helpful in distinguishing between what is normal and what is a healthy process. In other words, even if one is bellicose, we live in a violent political structure globally, and therefore it could be strategic, it could be protective. And so in other words, if an individual is healthy or normal, then whatever decision they make under whatever ideology would be life-affirming. But if a person is making decisions or makes patterns of decisions in a way that points to pathology, in other words, abnormalities in thinking, feeling, behaving, then that becomes a problem because it is destructive in the end, matter the pull toward that kind of decision making. I often say that even the electorate that has been so drawn to him and wanting him to be in power is showing signs of a poor state of public mental health in a way that we as health professionals have a duty, I believe, to point out, because because the difference between health and illness is that illness leads to damage, destruction, and death. I mean, it's a natural phenomenon. And so when it's within the wide range of normal human variation, we do not intervene, and there's no reason to intervene. But when it starts to get into the territory of pathology, then that's when most people may just recognize it as in terms of what they already know. In other words, most people don't deal with impaired individuals day in and day out. And therefore, they will see this as a variation of someone's personality, just Trump being Trump, or he's engaging in tough talk. Whereas we see signs of distinct pathology, in fact, instability, that indicates the need for further evaluation, even if we cannot pinpoint exactly what the disorder is. I mean, we don't have the complete picture, but there are many, many signs, psychological, cognitive, and neurological signs now that have shown up in public appearances that are very concerning. And even psychotic individuals are able to keep themselves together for 15 minutes at a time and can present themselves as normal. So the fact that we're seeing this in public appearances is actually more concerning, and that it fits so much of a pattern of pathology and lack of control rather than strategy.
Right.
We wouldn't be able to tell this at a cross-sectional moment, but by now we have seen a lot of reactions, a lot of presentations in real time over extended periods of time. We actually have a lot more information on the president than we do of any of our own patients.
Okay, so let's get a little bit specific here. So just to get a little bit more specific, there's this whole suite of functions that we have that are in your domain and also in my domain, neuroscience, are called executive function, being able to plan ahead. Mm-hmm. What you just said, self-control, being able to plan for the future, taking into context the actions of others, all this stuff. Can we can we just drill in just a little bit and getting away from the diagnosis idea, just the practical goal is, oh my gosh, is something dangerous to other people going to happen here? Can you explain to us some subset of behavior that you've observed that indicates, say, lack of normal control or lack of processes that you would normally expect from a president with those responsibilities? Just something a little concrete here.
Right. So I distinguish between a person's personal mental health and their function. So we're not speaking about diagnosis here, which is someone's private affair, even for a public official, but the public health threat that he poses and has already posed. He has already been dangerous. And for that, I also distinguish between a neuropsychiatric evaluation, which we have been calling for, and also a capacity evaluation. A capacity evaluation is ordinarily anything ranging from the capacity to stand trial, to make medical decisions for oneself, to sign a will. Capacity evaluations are done all the time.
Okay,
that
so for
really
instance, like, you know,
function.
Yeah, like I teach and I run a lab. And so you might evaluate my ability to do the job of teaching a class or my ability to run my laboratory, like that?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay, so now let's turn this into specificity. Evidence that here we have a case where the ability to carry out the job seems to be in pretty strong question.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So from the signs that he has shown, we cannot be sure that he has the ability to take in the information he needs to, as well as the advice that he needs, and to process that information, to manipulate it in ways that he would think about the real situation and real consequences before making sound, logical, reality-based decisions. We are not sure that he is capable of doing that. Those are the kinds of things that a capacity evaluation would test. And part of capacity is also more generally fitness for duty. And someone who is dangerous is also brings into question their fitness. And past violence is the best predictor for future violence. We have seen him being verbally aggressive. He has boasted about sexual assaults. He has incited violence in crowds, and he has endorsed violence in key public speeches, which actually is a greater danger for someone of such influence.
I mean, yes. I guess my question still, so how do we know? So to say this and to be speaking to members of Congress, I imagine some members of Congress, as you spoke to them, were like, well, you're describing a variation of many presidents I have served in Congress while they were in the White House, and there might be differences. But it gets back to where I was originally. Maybe how is Donald Trump specifically much different than other people said about President Bush?
So, for instance, Bill Clinton is said to have had a volcanic temper in private. That would be an example of a president who could keep it together when he's in front of the mic during the State of the Union address, door closes, turns red, yells and screams. So walk us through that, because, you know, we've got a baseline of, what, half a dozen modern presidents we could compare with.
Yes, actually, it may be of interest to you that the Congress members uniformly described, we have never dealt with a president like this before, and we are very concerned. And the first thing they mentioned was his access to the nuclear codes.
Yeah, well,
that's far before I mentioned anything else.
That is an issue.
So actually, many of them stopped me in the middle of my presentation saying, you don't have to convince us. We've been very concerned about this. In fact, they have waited for this meeting eagerly. Some have said, one person said it was the most eagerly awaited meeting in 11 years.
Yeah. Right.
That is how eager at least the Democratic lawmakers were.
And those are people who have been in the room with the guy, right? So,
yes.
So you talked with people who have actually spent time in the room with President Trump.
Exactly.
So for example, like the kinds of things that leak out through the news are things like private meeting of lawmakers, let's say the Republican caucus with President Trump. And right in the middle of the conversation, he will start talking about how he really won the popular vote or how mm-hmm. he got big crowds at the inauguration. So, you know, if I'm in the middle of teaching a class, I don't suddenly start talking about whatever, a repair in my house. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe actually I might. But the point is that in the middle of these meetings with lawmakers, things that leak out that don't seem quite appropriate. And so I'm just imagining what it's like being a lawmaker, encountering such mm-hmm. statements from someone in person. And there's that in-personness. Another example would be, things that he does when people are with him all day.
Yes, and the things that are leaking are out, none of it is surprising. That is what we would expect of someone who has shown this level of impairment, where he almost exists in his own reality, where he cannot connect to policy priorities or factual information in ways that, because he is so overwhelmed by his internal needs.
Are all the authors in the book The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, are they all in general agreement about these kinds of conclusions, or are there differences in the essays about what they're seeing?
Well, there are different perspectives that people bring, and I deliberately chose a wide range of not only backgrounds, but also angles that people bring and things that they were willing to talk about. The main consensus is dangerousness, and that is actually a universal consensus. In fact, you may find people differing on diagnoses. As I said, you can't really definitively say without all the information, so you'll have varying assertions. And there are differences in terms of what people perceive as ethical. Do we speak out about this or not? But in terms of the medical aspects, I don't believe that you would find a single serious mental health professional who has thought about this clearly who would say he is not dangerous. And in fact, I mean, I would allow people to have different levels of certainty based on their own expertise or experience with dangerous individuals. But so far, all across the political spectrum, I have not encountered one. And now I'm in touch with thousands of mental health professionals, as you may know, through the coalition.
How did you decide? Can I ask how it sounds like this is your first time really getting involved in the political arena in this way. How did you decide or kind of what motivated you now to do it? Was it simply watching the president? How did this happen? I'm just curious about how you became so involved.
Yes, I mean, it's the level of danger. You're right in that partisan politics, especially domestic politics, even never really interested me. As you know, my area is in global health, and I have been working with my area's specialty is violence prevention, and so I've been working on wars, gender-based violence, mass murders, all throughout the world, usually cross-culturally. And so politics in this country was just never a big interest for me. I mean, I voted during presidential election years, and it didn't really matter as much, you know, what the party was, although now it seems more like one is more reality-based than the other. And as a psychiatrist, I have to stick with the one that's more sane, if you will. But I didn't really even think about it over the course of the campaign. Of course, I had concerns within even seconds, you might say, of watching Mr. Trump. And I knew about him a little bit from growing up in New York City. I heard about him from the 80s and all the ways he cheated workers and swindled people, but I didn't really think of him as particularly dangerous until I really thought about it. And the way I came to think about it was the morning after election, starting at 8 a.m., when my phone was ringing off the hook and my email account was overflowing with messages from people I had been in contact with before, usually regarding prison reform and the violence prevention work that I do, civil society organizations, patient advocacy groups, lawyers, students, documentary filmmakers, members of state government. They were all getting in touch with me because they were afraid of the violence that was to come. And I had to think about my own involvement, and I made a decision right then that, well, if I dedicated my life to studying and preventing violence, would I turn away in the face of the greatest violence that we could ever face? And this was very true. Their assessment was correct. And therefore, that's when I considered this to be a domain of my own involvement. Before that, I was never political. I was never even registered with any party. Just wasn't an area of interest for me.
Did you worry, or do you worry? I'm sure you've received a lot of pushback that you're entering into an incredibly polarized political atmosphere where, you know, all kinds of arguments such as the one you're making will be used for sure as political mm-hmm. fodder. I bet the next president can be accused, whoever it is in this environment will be accused of something similar just because of the atmosphere we're in. I mean, we heard all kinds mm-hmm. of claims, obviously, about President Obama, about President Bush. Did you worry, given where you were coming from, about trying to make the case not only that President Trump, that he's dangerous, but trying to make the case that this kind of expertise can bring weight in the political arena we have today without being misused, without being twisted, and that it actually is potentially constructive and that you could persuade minds with what you have to say?
All I can do is continue to bring my expertise. Psychiatric and medical phenomena are natural occurrences. I actually feel that applying psychiatric knowledge to the political realm can not only be done responsibly, in fact, forensic psychiatrists do this all the time. I think it should be noted that we have our own methods and ethical guidelines themselves encourage us to do so. But as scientific fields describing natural phenomena, medicine and psychiatry have the ability to serve as neutralizing grounds, I believe, for politics. Politics might do well to modernize to become more evidence-based, focusing more on problems that need solving and proven solutions based on evidence can help mitigate the excessive focus on power or partisan struggles. Unfortunately, the field itself has conflated this, what expert witnesses, so-called expert witnesses, do with the politicization of psychiatry, but the two are distinct, and the field itself makes a clear distinction. All I can do is continue to educate about educate about what expert witnesses do, that we only speak about medical matters. We do not enter into legal decision-making territory the same way we don't political decision-making territory. It just means that, the court systems, recognizing the limits of lay analysis, have long ago set up a routine process for receiving input from experts. And without expert input, this means that experts assist the legal and political bodies to make informed decisions based on evidence and based on knowledge. And so without expert input, there is a danger of everything being politicized, everything being underestimated or overestimated depending on political agendas. And that is where we can be more of a neutralizing force.
Well, I think broadening that out beyond the thing that you're in the public eye for right now, there is this general question of the role of expert knowledge in public life right now. And so as far as I can tell, the huge challenge to anyone with a lot of expertise is finding ways to contribute that expertise and keep it separate, both in order to maintain credibility with the public and also to avoid letting one's own non-professional judgments get in, because we're all, we all have political opinions and we all have views about public life and what society ought to be. And so I think that, just speaking for myself, that's a big challenge.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, in psychiatry, there is a process called autognosis, that is knowing oneself. You employ it with every clinical encounter, because if you have strong ideologies that do not allow you to fully treat professionally someone, a next neo-Nazi, for example, or someone who murders, I mean, those are the people I see, then you have to be the judge as to whether or not you can be professional in that setting and responsibly recuse yourself if you cannot.
Well, I would, in this case, I guess I'd make the analogy to, in the domain of, say, fire prevention. You don't necessarily need to know what the causes of the fire were, but if there is a fire threat, then you better be prepared to put out the fire.
Exactly.
Okay. Let me lower the tone a little bit here and ask you, have you ever watched Celebrity Apprentice? Because, that's a big source of video. Okay. I'm not judging. Okay. But
I haven't watched any TV.
I don't watch TV. But the reason is that it's got this documentary record of hours and hours of footage of, filtered through the production company that produced that program. It's got hours and hours of footage, both of how people in the United States see our current president and also what he's like, because, he's a public figure. And so there's decades of video footage of him over the years. And that's a relatively recent look at the guy. And so I'm just curious whether you've had occasion to look at that and say, he wasn't inciting violence against people on the set, presumably, as far as anyone knows. And so I think that's an interesting...
I wouldn't consider that the most reliable data. I would veer more toward interviews that he has done where he's where it's
like
open-ended
his New York Times interview.
Express his thoughts frankly, yes. Mm. And you can tell that he does better when his needs are supported, when he is approved of, when he is welcomed and viewed upon positively. He seems to need a lot of buttressing to be able to keep himself together. But yes, his New York Times interview would be one aspect. He didn't lose his temper or anything, but you can see that his thought process, his speech patterns are actually quite impaired.
And then just so I understand, so practically, so you've published, you've written in news magazines about this, you have the book, and many people might be persuaded. I'm sure others are not persuaded. But in terms of how do we make this part of a kind of systematic examination of all presidents, like the physical examination, how would that work? And so how would it work so that someone can judge if a president is in that realm where they are not disagreeable, they are not people that part of the population doesn't like, but they are truly a danger and incapable of governing? How would that actually work just for a layperson?
Oh, yes. I mean, the absence of a fitness for duty exam, just as we have for every military officer and every civilian service person, this being absent for the commander in chief is the reason why we're in this predicament in the first place. And also those who handle nuclear weapons, officers who handle them and load them are required to undergo rigorous screening processes that every year on a continual basis. And yet the one in charge of those weapons has no such requirement. So a standard capacity evaluation would be helpful for all presidential candidates and presidents.
And how do you do that without turning that into a political football? Because I'm just listening to this, and I'm thinking, okay, we're going to use, you know, like if I'm on a side that's adverse to some candidate, I'm going to say, okay, Senator Warren has to take this. Kamala Harris has to take this fitness exam. So I'm just wondering how one could do that in a domain where there's stigmatization of mental, mental function getting out of whack. What's the route towards doing that responsibly?
Yeah, the absence of any discourse about mental health issues in public for a very long time is one of the reasons why there's stigmatization, the only reason why only mental health terminology is used as insults or epithets. We don't do that for people who are disabled or who are physically impaired anymore. We don't hush about them, and we don't judge the person because of them. And yet, psychological impairment is just as real, just as debilitating, and just as objectively observable as physical ones. And psychiatric diagnoses are among the most reliable in medicine. So I think just having a more reasonable perspective and considering the dangers that could arise if we did not have such a system in place, because the Office of the Presidency is not immune to mental health issues the way it's not immune to physical issues. And so for us to decide as a people that this is a reasonable and basic thing to do, it does not mean that a bunch of psychiatrists decide who can and cannot be president. It simply means that we would ensure that the person who is in that office has the bare minimal capability to carry out the function to which he has been elected.
Yeah, without meaning to get into too much of the weeds here, I'm just going to read from a quote from a Republican Senate staffer on this topic. And this person says, and here's the difficulty with what you're suggesting. The Republican staffer says anonymously in this piece in the Atlantic, "I'm not particularly fond of the president, but I think this mental instability talk is Bush League. It's no different than the birther issue. It's trying to beat a political foe on a technicality rather than at the ballot box." And so the difficulty is that there's this problem with taking something that maybe when things were fine and relatively stable politically, that might have been a time to introduce it. And now we're in this fairly unusual time. And right now the house is on fire, in many people's view. And bringing it up now, while the house being on fire is why we're talking about it, it also raises the issue of how it gets received in the current environment.
Right, right. So it's something that should have been in place from the start. It's a glaring omission, but it was not. And so we need to decide at this point. Perhaps it's not a routine capacity evaluation that the president needs. It's urgent evaluation and treatment. But the medical standard of care is unable to be employed because we are creating such an exception and protection around this person. We treat the president not as a public servant who is employed by the public, but rather someone who commands and is untouchable in some respects, like an emperor or a king. And that in itself is a problem. The 25th Amendment has often been brought up, even though it's an area outside of my domain and I couldn't comment on it. People have said that it's unrealistic. From my point of view as a health professional, if the actual conditions apply, then there ought to be a way to carry it out. If it's inhibited in a certain way, that points to defects in the political system. If we cannot remove a president who is showing obvious incapacities, then that is a problem. And just as the political parties have inhibited the system of checks and balances from operating correctly. So I think this is an issue that we have to deal with as a whole now, as a people, rather than leave it up to the politicians. Obviously, the politicians do not seem able to fix the political system themselves. And also, there is a problem of conflict of interest. There's so much conflict of interest in the political system, so much ties with special interest, that in any scientific setting, in any academic setting, you would not qualify any of them to be to serve in the positions that they are in. And yet we have this system that is undermining democracy and, as a result, public mental health. And that is a concern of mine.
Well, on that note, we will have to close up the show. Again, we want to thank you, Dr. Bandy Lee, the author of The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, a best-selling book by Thomas Dunn Books. Thank you for joining our show.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that wraps up our episode, everyone. Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Thanks, and we will be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.